All right, it's March 2016. Delta is only a month away, or something like a month away, since we do not yet have a broadcast date. And we're back for another episode of Macross Speaker Podcast. To my right, I have...
Renato. Don't pause. Keep going.
And to my left, I have...
Egan.
And this is, of course, Gwyn Campbell, otherwise known as Torchiddle on the boards. Right. And today, we are here... Thank you, Renato. Known otherwise as Renato. Today, we're here to talk about one thing and one thing only, and that is...
Kazutaka Miyatake.
We need, like, a concert introduction, like at the Crossover Live.
Next stage! Next stage! Kazutaka Miyatake.
He really does need his own hype, man. Just goes around wherever he goes.
The Kaz. The Kaz-tack.
Why are we talking about Miyatake? Well, there was an exhibit. In fact, I seem to remember, Renato, last year, in October, I logged onto Macross World. Front page, there's this big post by you saying, "Stop the presses, it's the big one." That's a direct quote.
I don't remember that.
That's a direct quote.
In all caps, right?
Okay. I was like, what are you so hyped about? And you're hyped about an announcement of an exhibit.
Uh-huh.
On a boat.
We're on a boat.
So the whole thing that got you so hyped up, to refresh your memory, was that they'd announced a Kazutaka Miyatake exhibit on an actual boat and...
It's a battleship.
It floats?
It's the Mikasa.
Okay. It used to float.
Yeah. All right, my definition of a boat is now blown out of the water. Right, so this exhibit was held from October 24th to November 23rd. It was on, as you mentioned, the Mikasa Memorial Battleship.
Yeah.
And we went. And before we get into that... I think it's probably a good idea to talk briefly about who the heck Miyatake is. And, you know, who is he? What has he done? Why is this a big deal? So what has he done? Well, the thing with Miyatake is, in my opinion at least, you know, he's less known... He's not that well known to anyone who's not a hardcore fan. And that's because he is a mechanical designer. And as a result, his work isn't in your face... as he's designed it all the time. So if you have someone like Carl Moore, he also does some illustrations, and of course he designs Valkyries. He also directs and produces, so he's out there, his name's out there. Even if you look at someone like Tenjin, because he's a visual artist, his art's out there on model kits and books and whatnot. You look at Miyatake, to really get into what he does, you need to get into the settings documents and design workbooks. So his stuff doesn't hit... A lot of people have seen his stuff and don't know it because they see it in animated form, but they don't know who did it. And often, you know, Kawamori's Mori's name's attached to something, and people can often overlook Miyatake. I suppose if we talk about the three things he's probably best known for in general.
The BF-19's hands?
All right, ignore that. All right, and correct me if I'm wrong. I would say the powered suits from Starship Troopers that Studio Nue did, for Space Battleship Yamato, and for Macross. Those are the... I mean, he's been involved in a lot more than that.
Yeah.
But if you ask anyone if they know of something Miyatake has done, they probably pick one of those three things.
Yeah.
But he's done so much more. I mean, let's do a round table here. Some things Miyatake has done. Let's
see. Just about anything that's been in the Matsumoto Leiji universe, mm-hmm, has been designed or redesigned from Matsumoto's own original work by him. So if there's anything from that old space opera era of the 70s and beyond, you probably liked one of his works.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'll take a step back, actually. So just within Macross itself, for example, you know, of course there's the Macross itself, mm-hmm, and pretty much every Macross.
Everything, almost, apart from the Valkyries and...
Well, I was going to get to that. I was going.
Oh, okay, all right. You're building up to it.
Well, as you're saying, all the actual spaceships and the Macross itself, because there is a sense of continuity there, right? In design and in ships lasting longer than Valkyries. So yeah, all the Valkyries, mm-hmm, are constantly renewed. The line, the form factor of the ships, kind of stays similar throughout. And that's Miyatake's.
Well, some people might argue with that. I mean, Battle 7 doesn't really about much of...
Well, this is true, I guess. But...
And it goes beyond just spacecraft. Aliens from all sorts, from the first Macross onward.
Right.
All the biological stuff he's also worked on.
So. Right, so, I mean, you introduce him as a mecha designer, but it's a lot more than that.
As a mechanical designer.
Mechanical designer.
Setting all designs besides characters.
Mm-hmm. He was credited as mecha designer on the original Macross. Mm-hmm. But for Do You Remember Love, you remember what his credit was, right? So it's production design.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes way beyond just the mecha. The mecha is a part of the world setting, the world view that Macross takes place within.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually going to form a large part of what we're going to discuss today. The idea of reality within this world that they have created,
mm-hmm.
right? So when there is something which looks really realistic, and this is hardcore, gritty, whatever, you're probably approaching it from a different angle to what he intended it to be. He wants you to believe that this can exist within the world that they have set out, within this framework. So
that there's a world. Oh, go ahead. There's a world beyond the frame of the film still. That, you know, it's something else that continues beyond what you see on the 35mm.
Exactly, so, right. And that's very, very anime-like.
Yeah, so it's reality within the setting as opposed to realism, which would be based on what we...
Right. It's almost, you know what? It's almost like the Impressionists did in the 18th, 19th centuries. They basically said, like, Monet and Van Gogh, all these people, you know, photography was starting to gain some traction, and painting had become uber-realistic by that point, hyper-realistic. Realism was no longer interesting to any of these artists, so they wanted different ways of interpreting reality in their own way, in their own language, in their own format. So that's basically what this is, right? Science fiction is not really a facsimile of real life. It's a new, wholly
a world
generated,
unto itself.
Yeah, yes. With its own rules and its own themes and topics.
So, in other words, if something is true to the reality of the setting, of the rules that have been established within that world, it has realism for that world. But if we just speak in generally of realism, something's realistic, then that's from our standpoint.
Exactly. So, I don't know about you, but I find it far more interesting to see a well-crafted, intricate, working world separate from our own that we can, as Egan said, look into through this kind of window, which is the TV screen or the manga page or whatever it may be, right? Otherwise, I just watch a documentary.
Right.
You know, so so that is pretty much the foundation that you've got to be like. I don't want you to just accept it blindly, but you've got to understand that that's where he's coming from when he approaches design work. It's not just mecha design. Draw me a robot, Miyatake, to put in this anime. No, you have to know what the work is about. What is the anime about? What is it trying to show? What is the essence of it? And how do we give symbols and like tropes to that?
So, as part of this, the importance to a Macross fan, as you're saying then, is that he has had this incredible influence and input over the world of Macross.
Yeah.
In most of its versions to date.
All of them, as far as I know, except for two.
So, you know, all the Zentradi design.
Frontier.
Yeah. Well, Zentradi design, ship design, cockpits, like all the detail you see in the cockpit
well,
of the 21.
That.
Yeah. Now, I'm talking, first of all, examples people can bring to mind.
Okay,
all right.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
As a springboard into the large world, right? So, but on the other hand of that, you've got things like the original Macross, things like the cockpit of a 21, the bridge of the Macross in Do You Remember Love, that incredible amount of detail in there.
Yeah,
so he
yeah.
did that. But on the other hand, he also did the Proto Devlin.
Yes.
Designs, right?
Yes.
And for example, when it comes not just the mecha and biologics, for the ships and beyond those, the city Altera from Do You Remember Love?
Yes.
The islands, the various things that you see in the background that create the look of the world and the atmosphere of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That he was responsible for.
Do you remember love? Do you remember the
It's almost like I'm addressing you in a Cockney slang. Do you remember, love? Do you remember that movie, love?
A cup of tea.
You remember the scene where Hikaru and Misa go down to what is later revealed to shock horror be the Earth,
mm-hmm.
right? And it looks so alien.
Mm-hmm.
Those clouds and stuff like that. You know, that kind of concept is that it's... I mean, it's obviously him and Kawamori, because they were talking about that right. together. That also is part of production design. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not about, let's put this here and right. put that right. in this thing. Well, they set out everything. They map it all out. Well, the writing. The protoculture writing and the Zentradi writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people who are supposed to exist.
Right.
Right. Even though they say that Zentradi doesn't have culture, so it's kind of strange that they would have... But they probably would have annotations and things like that. So...
Well, he's often credited as conceptual design, which is also a really difficult term to pin down, but I think you've almost described right there.
Yeah, these creators choose these titles on purpose. I mean, you know
to
what...
To confuse us, because they do
everything.
You know
what Kawamori's official title is, right? That he chose himself.
Visionary... Vision creator?
Vision creator.
Yes.
Vision creator.
He created my sight. I could not see yeah. my vision if it was not for Kawamori.
Yeah, he makes spectacles.
Blind, but now I can see...
And Miyatake originally to me was known for his work in the original Yamato with regards to the actual ship itself. It is what he's most well known for. But then I noticed he was also involved in the recent remake Yamato 2199 but almost exclusively doing biological work, so biological art and design. So all the mutant plants that appear on Earth due to the radiation mm-hmm. bombing, the gamma-less planets and all those foreign worlds, the structures, that was all him. And of course, other than that, he's worked on Dirty Pair, Orgus, Crusher Joe, Dumbine, Razaphon, Eureka 7. You got anything you want
to
add?
One thing that caught our eyes when we went to the exhibit is that there was something he worked on that predated Yamato, Majigger. Trans or Z for some other
Mazinga, right.
Yeah, it's like Majigger's Zeta. He worked on the inner design. The,
yes.
If you open it up and see the inner skeleton of the exostructure of the robot, he did that part.
Yeah.
So. And it's interesting because the pamphlet that was at the exhibit, and it is literally just like a two-page pamphlet, has this incredible list on the back of things he's worked on, and it takes up almost an entire A4 page in very small font. And you know, when it comes to Macross, he was even involved with the VFX and VFX2 games. He was involved with Macross M3 on the Dreamcast. He has had not just in animation overall, but especially in Macross, this huge impact.
If there's any franchise you were interested in that had robots or spacecraft or space opera from the 70s, 80s, 90s. Or even the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
Odds are, Miyatake was involved in it.
Yeah.
So...
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
So let's go back to the beginning then, shall we? If you say Miyatake to most people who know of the man, the word Nue, in particular Studio Nue, often comes up. So, Renato, would you like to take a step back and tell us exactly where this all began?
Where Studio Nue began? Miyazaki.
Okay, cut that, all right? So wait for it, give yourself a pause.
You can leave it. Da, 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 da. So anyway, Miyatake.
You can say it.
Miyatake was... he grew up in Yokosuka. He... this is stuff that I'm... looking at in this interview that's included with the mini pamphlet leaflet thing that they gave out.
Although,
at this exhibition.
If I can quickly say, you've also on the front page over the last 12 months, I think, done those two other translations of interviews with him. One from the STF1 Papercraft book,
yes,
and one from the August Toy, was it?
Yes, but nobody cares about those.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I mean, if you have time, go read them. They're quite enlightening. I like them. But yeah, I thought they were interesting, so I translated them.
Speaking of Zentradi writing, look at those notes.
Yes,
I can't read your handwriting, Renato. Anyway,
neither can I. But when he was younger, because he lived in Yokosuka and they've got the old ships there, He used to like draw pictures with his aunt, who was also an artist, and you know, he used to draw a picture of this ship, and his aunt would draw the ship as well with watercolors or whatever. And he would tell this story about this old man came up to them and said, "Oh wow, your drawing is pretty good." And he looked at his drawing and he said, "Oh, your ship really looks like it can float." And he looked at his aunt's drawing and said, "Nah, yours will sink." And it was at that moment, like, he was probably like 5 or something. It was at that moment he started wondering about reality and realism within a two-dimensional picture. But he says that when he was growing up, his grades were always bad with regards to art. He was never in good terms with his art teachers. He was always told not to draw the way he was drawing. And it was because he realized... in retrospect, with hindsight, he realized later on that what he was doing is he was having problems drawing things that were in front of him because of perspective changes. So he knew that there was a thing about perspective that you had to somehow follow rules, and there was some kind of vanishing point method of putting a three-dimensional drawing down on a two-dimensional piece of paper, but he couldn't work out what it was. And so he was experimenting by drawing lots of different lines over and over, and so his drawings all became really messy, and his art teachers didn't understand what he was trying to do, and he obviously couldn't word it properly, so it took a long time for him to understand that. But he later on he realized that he already had some kind of idea that perspective was a thing. And when we were children, I'm sure we didn't know what it... Like, we would draw random scribbles, and they look three-dimensional to us, but it looks like garbage to every other adult, right? So there's that. He was struggling with that. He wanted to be a biologist, so he entered graduate school, apparently. But by the time he saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, his world completely changed. And he said, "Oh my God, this is it. This is what I want to do. I don't know what I want to do, but I know it has to do something with this." And so he started going to SF conventions, and there he met Matsuzaki Kenichi, who is one of the other founding members of Studio Inoue. And gradually they gathered lots of people, like Matsuzaki, Kato Naoyuki was the other person who was on the talk show event as part of the exhibition, and Takachiho-san. So they were the original four members of Studio Inoue. And Studio Inoue, at that time, was basically just a group of like-minded people, because there were no one like that around him in Yokosuka. Like-minded people who wanted to do sci-fi stuff. Apparently he'd already established this group prior to Inoue called SF Central Art. Didn't really go into detail about what that entailed and how many people were in there. It sounds like it's just him. I don't know, there's probably more. I really wanted to interview him about that. But basically, Studio Inoue is a design agency, and they would do illustrations for science fiction stuff. So the Hayakawa Bunko small prints of the Japanese translated novels, like the Heinlein Starship Troopers and stuff, they would get commissioned artwork. So they Hayakawa came up to them and said, "Do you like to do an illustration?" And so, of course, the illustration came to be that iconic powered suit that they all designed together. And and apparently Matsuzaki or Kato or somebody, I think it was Kato in the talk show, I think Kato said that he negotiated with Hayakawa to have more. Like, to have illustrations inside the book as well. And Miyatake kind of felt that, "I don't know about having illustrations inside the book." Probably because it made it more like a children's storybook or something. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, that idea that there is a world behind the story that you're telling, and the real shock of 2001 A Space Odyssey was not just that it was completely different to every sci-fi thing that ever existed prior to that, but for him it was also like, the more he did the research, the more he realized that Clark had actually started taking out more of the realistic sci-fi aspects and elements of that that story to make the story stand as its story and to have it to make it have its own identity, right? Which calls back to what we were talking about, which is basically the MO of Studio Nui and Macross and everything that Miyazaki had worked on. So everything that he was saying is basically that it's not adding stuff, it's taking stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
That's what design work is. You take reality away from it until it's its own thing, but it still has the essence of reality in it because you're being true to the work, to whatever the essence of that work is. And the few people who understood that were those founding four members, and that's what Studio Nui stands for, apparently to this day still.
And of course, it expanded a bit with other members joining over the years.
Like Kawamori?
Like Kawamori, probably one of the better known these days, once members of Studio Nui.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk about him?
No, we've already done two podcasts on Kawamori. I'm good with Kawamori for now.
But even folks like Mikimoto has spent a little time over in Studio Way. There are various people that were attracted by the ideas and the concepts that those founding members had created. So
yes, of course.
This is something we want to be a part of. We're college students, but we see something there that's our future.
Yeah, Kawamori and Mikimoto, they watched Yamato, they watched Gundam. They know that Studio Way worked on it, so they went over, knocked on the door, and they were let in, and I guess Miyatake wanted to keep Kawamori around, and he told Mikimoto to go over to Artland, where he could develop his character work under Ishiguro. So it's really interesting. It's a very, very small circle, but very, very influential.
Unbelievably one. So. And the fact that these people are so influential even today, I'll admit, until this exhibit, I hadn't really given much thought to what Miyatake had done in the last 15 years, 20 years, like post Macross Plus and 7, I hadn't really given much thought to it. And once I realized how much he'd been doing, even now, it was quite eye opening.
Yeah.
We have a list of credits from the flyer we've been talking about, and easily a third of the credits are actually from the 21st century onward.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, so he's been working constantly.
His late age, he's still outputting amazing work.
And when we say late age, he is, as of this exhibit, he was 66. He would have had
probably
a birthday.
Yeah, so he's 1949. He's 1950. No, 49?
Yep, 1949.
Okay.
So he was 66. Kato is 63. So to still have this amount of output, it's great because who's going to replace him? This is the problem with a lot of these people.
The problem with a lot of these people is that they're not... they're not masters. You know what I mean? They don't have apprentices.
They don't train.
The closest generation would have been the mentorship that Miyatake provided to Kawamori.
Yeah. Mentor is what I'm talking about. Yeah.
And there's not someone who's, the next Miyatake.
Yeah. Itano does a lot of that, though. Itano is, most of what he works on now is basically training young animators.
Yes.
Mm. And he does a lot of that out of anger, seemingly, because he's always complaining about. He's always complaining about the Senmongakko, which are the vocational
schools.
Art schools. Mm-hmm. They teach it wrong. They teach you this, but it should be this, and blah blah blah.
Well, it's interesting because many of these original creators from the 80s, 70s, and 80s, the more I meet them or come across them in talk shows, and I know, Renato, you tend to have a lot more direct exposure to them through your work.
Well, not to say, I asked you to come to a talk show this morning, you didn't want to.
You let me finish. I was busy preparing for a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
The eccentric nature of many of these people is something I don't see as reflected as... I don't see as often in modern creators. I don't know if it's just so I'm not communicating with as many modern creators, but...
Yeah, I feel like people are shy now.
I really? Think one reason is that many of the ones that were of that same nature, like you said, eccentric, they're less going to anime, more going to games. You get a lot of auteurs in film theory.
Yes.
But their vision is going into games. They're pouring their ideas and thoughts into there.
Hmm.
And for that matter, Miyatake has been doing more games. A lot of the credits he's had in the 21st century were actually for games.
Right. But at the same time, out of all of us, Gwyn, you know it better than any of us do, like the future of the gaming industry.
Don't get me started.
I mean, I forgot his name. Hideo Kojima. Yes.
Kojima.
Right?
Ah, oh, that's
that
not
whole
a good,
thing.
That's not a good example.
That's not a good example.
The Western.
Konami shut down their gaming department, didn't they?
Yeah, Konami has been wanting to get out of gaming for a long time.
Konami is a game company and will always be a game company in my mind.
Well,
they're trying to get a console game.
Yeah.
Other kind of gaming that's supposedly more lucrative.
Well, they've had their, you know, Las Vegas, their Nevada gambling license for over a decade, decade and a half, and that makes them a lot of money. And they have, you know, clubs. This is completely off topic, but I mean, a lot of things like Kojima, the Western press likes to have a creator to hold up and be the representative of what's being made. Gaming is much more of a
collaborative
effort, well put. And there needs to be a figurehead. I mean, I've been asked to arrange interviews with gaming teams where I can't, because no one in the team wants to stand up and be the representative for the whole team, because it's a team effort. You know? So when you get people who will put themselves out there, that is, by their very nature, they are quite eccentric.
Eccentric, yes. Kojima is definitely, he wants to be a star, right? He wants to be like one of those famous Spielberg-type director. Auteurs, like you said,
So, you know, listening to
I mean, Miyatake, his game's great, don't get anything wrong.
You know, Miyatake, listening to Kato. I even think, you know, they're more eccentric than Kawamori, although what I hear about Kawamori behind the scenes puts him at a similar level, to be honest. But yeah, it's just an interesting, I don't know, characteristic of these original creators. You don't see coming up in anime, at least, in a younger generation. And as a result of them being this kind of eccentric type, they aren't, as you said, the mentoring type.
Yeah.
They weren't mentored, as a general rule. I mean, Kawamori was, but generally they really weren't.
Yeah.
You know, in Miyatake's case, he got his experience by hanging out at a naval base and looking at warships.
Yeah.
And because they weren't mentored, I get the feeling they don't have a sense of how to mentor others. They keep working.
You know what a major difference is?
Mm-hmm.
Is that younger generations have so much popular culture readily accessible to them that they're living the anime life to begin with. You know, and they're coming into the anime industry because they've been influenced by so much anime. Whereas Miyatake, you know, Tomino, all these people who are really the first and second generations of anime creators came outside of that and brought that experience and those influences into the anime industry, therefore evolving it. Kawamori is one of the rare examples of people who actually was interested in anime and stuff like that.
And for that matter, Gainax, similar, where they were anime fans.
Otakus, downwards. Right? Yeah, the otakus becoming pros is what happened in the 80s.
Brings up some advice that I think Tomino, Miyazaki, Anno have said when anyone asks them.
Yeah.
Always people ask them, how do I become anime creators? Live the real life.
Yeah.
Go out there, find it, because you're not going to be able to create ideas based on create new ideas if all your ideas come from anime.
Yeah.
Go out there, find out what's out there, and then bring them into anime.
Yeah. So
that's what Miyatake did.
Right.
Exactly. So the whole mentorship thing. I mean, earlier I was praising Itano, but it's a double-edged sword, really. Right. You got to bring something into it. You got to, of course, learn about the history and what these guys did and how they did it, but at the same time, you can't just be expected to replicate that ad infinitum and then somehow, you know, keep this tradition, this lineage going.
And this is coupled with that larger overall problem in that, you know, working conditions and pay in the anime industry is so terrible
indeed.
You've got to be a fan to want to stick around, and therefore you have people replicating this stuff over and over.
The latest Janica, which is the Japanese animation
Cartoons Association.
White paper came out, report on the animation industry. On average, people working in the anime industry in Tokyo are making 40,000 yen a month.
400?
They're not making 40,000 yen. They're
taking home.
They're taking home 40,000.
Okay, so that's after superannuation.
Yeah,
tax,
should be qualifying for that. That survey is for young animators, like the people who are just starting out. So they're basically, if you want to start an anime industry, you have to live with your parents. Some of them have lived in those internet cafes because that's the only place they can afford to, because they can't get rent. Because
not all of them come from Tokyo, right?
Fortunately, the average gets higher. Yeah, that's right. If you have a place in Tokyo, then you could do the animation. If you don't live in Tokyo, you have to find a place that will accept you below what most rent can be had in Tokyo. It gets better. Like, that survey result was for people in their 20s, the young people just starting out. It doubles when you get to your 30s, 40s, but that's still not a lot. Still, like, given what they work on, the skill set, that's one reason so many of them go into gaming, because you get slightly more.
You get better. It's not great, but a bit more.
Yeah, it's really some of the answers that those animators gave in the questionnaires, they all said that, in their mid-30s, they're really seriously considering a career change. They want to continue doing animation, but it's not paying what they need to, maybe they want to start a family.
Yeah.
Not even survive. Even if they can survive, they want to move on.
True.
In their life stage, right? And there's no guarantee that anyway, we're kind of off topic zone here.
So let's bring it back on. Let's talk about this exhibit, because we went to this exhibit and it was, as we mentioned, on the Mikasa.
Mikasa es tu casa.
Had either of you been down to it before?
No,
that was my first time.
Yeah, same here. All right, so it was
it's my avatar on Facebook. I'm holding up the two guns. You took that photo.
I did. So the Mikasa was commissioned in 1902, going by the notes I had. And I have to say, because at the moment it's kind of it's a historical piece, and they've got the entire thing done up with all this great information, bilingual, even the audio stuff you can have in English or Japanese. It's really worth the trip. I was surprised I enjoyed the ship itself so much.
Also, it helped that the weather was nice.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a spring day, but it was...
Yeah.
It was getting cold.
I think the bilingual part of that whole exhibit is part of the history, because as we found out when we went over there, it was originally a British warship that the Japanese bought.
Yeah, it was built in British dockyards.
It also works in with Miyatake and his interest in both Western and Japanese, modern and historical. His roots in Yokosuka feeds that his imagination for that.
So the ship was, as I said, it was commissioned in 1902 as part of the Russo-Japanese War. At one point, apparently, its magazine blew, which almost sunk it. It was later fixed, but then decommissioned in 1922. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, apparently the Allied forces, the occupying forces, demanded that they strip all the guns from the ship, worried it could be used against them. So it was stripped of all its guns and left pretty much derelict for many, many years. Now, I think it was around the 70s, there was a movement to restore it.
Yeah.
And it was restored and made into this museum piece.
Yes.
And it was really good. And some of it is still original. Like, when we first got onto the ship, there was a note saying many of the actual wooden planks you're walking on the deck here are from the original ship from 1902. So there's already this incredible sense of history. And we spent a good hour looking around the ship before we even got near the exhibit.
Yeah.
Not the least not the least, because they had deck guns that we can actually man, turn, rotate.
We were shooting all the little kids who were walking past.
Yeah, they had a playground right next to it. So.
Just so you can the next bombard generation. It.
Yeah, I think the whole ship was basically a gallery. It was kind of like an exhibition unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
You had lots of items from the original ship, and then you also had lots of models of what it looked like at a certain period of time, lots of old photographs and paintings as well.
Yeah.
It was enormous and well worth the visit, even without Miyatake stuff. And the Miyatake was just a tiny room
in the middle. That's also one point I was going to make, in that below decks, I think there were about three levels below decks, and there were, cafeterias set out as they would have been in the early 1900s. There were different rooms that were all display pieces. There were other exhibits as well. Oh, they had the bathrooms? Yeah,
they were interesting.
There were other exhibits. There were things like showing how they could use a cannon in the dining room, which was kind of interesting. They changed the windows to stick a gun, cannon through it. And in the belly of this ship, like I'm talking the lowest floor, right in the center, surrounded by corridors and other rooms, there is a somewhat makeshift display space.
Yeah.
In this circular room. And it was not huge by any account.
It's not classy at all. It's like one of those, you know, yeah, like you said, those makeshift walls that they used to, like office partitions, basically. Right.
And, you know,
they pinned all these, to us, priceless artworks to.
And the roof is just, you know, the roof of this belly of the ship. It's all piping and
just it's not completely out there.
It's not glamorous at all, no. It was really interesting. And it took us a while to actually find the exhibit within this ship, because you literally had to go around the whole ship, second...
And
then eventually down to the belly, the third floor, where they had this exhibit.
We got to talk about this. I'm going to find it on my phone.
Oh, the monitor?
Yeah. Where is it?
Oh.
It's kind of like...
Flashback to the
1980s, 8-bit, weird Atari 2600 kind of monitor that said 2015 November on it.
This is why...
What was that, anyway?
It was the middle press.
Yeah, well, why do you need a monitor? I've never seen, like...
Because to them, at that time, it's, oh, we want to make it high-tech.
Look at this.
We're going to put a CRT tube on it.
It says 2015, 11, 15.
Probably had a firmware update. Via dial-up. I will put a picture of that up with the podcast so people can see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It was bizarrely out of place.
I loved it. Somehow very appropriate that we're going down Vaporwave. Into the bowels of a ship to see an exhibition for someone who has been, you know, prolific since the 70s and 80s to see something like that there.
And the exhibit was, as we mentioned, in this tiny makeshift room. It had about, I think it was just over 70 pieces of art in there from memory. And there was a small case in the middle with some models and toys based on Miyatake designs.
Which, if you are a fan of Starship Troopers, if you are a fan of any of the works he did, Dunbine, to see so many of his works in 3D, and some of them which were custom one-off that we'll never see anywhere else.
And some of which are broken.
They just left the parts there. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Some had been broken. So we walk into this exhibit, and of course it's strictly no photos, as is normally the case. There is no exhibit booklet. There's this tiny 2-page pamphlet we get with it, which has an abundance of information in it, but it doesn't have the art reproduced in it or anything like that.
The most we can get in terms of art was...
a set of postcards and a poster, all of which had the same kind of art. So we walk in, and as you said, Egan, the first thing we see is a Mazinga picture with this cutaway Mazinga. And just around the corner to that was probably the most impressive piece of the exhibit, which we'll get to in a moment. But moving past that, you know, we had what? We had the Lovely Angel from Dirty Pair with a few different designs from that.
Yeah, different versions of it.
Different versions, which were pretty interesting. To be honest, very little actual Macross content. There's like, what, two pictures of the SCF-1?
Yeah.
And some random, the most bizarre, like the trash picker from Do You Remember Love?
Yes.
And signal lights from the streets of the Macross.
Yeah.
Some, you know, random stuff, but it also shows you the sense of
all
the little background detail to create the world that is in Macross, he was responsible for.
Yes. And that, to me, is more important than the Quiddlen Rao or, you know, the Macross itself, really, if you think about it, because it illustrates what he's trying to get across, that mecha design is just one part of the process of creating a world, right? And I think that's really the intention of this exhibition.
I don't disagree. Yeah. I just also think that's not necessarily what I was expecting walking in. So it was an educational
process.
Amazing as some of the art pieces that were there, there's no way that even an entire ship will have the output that he has done over these decades.
Right, and being such a small selection, I'll admit, I was expecting it more to focus on, you know, the big ships and the mecha designs he was famous for, things that would draw people to it. Not what they picked. Before I continue, though, this is a very noob question, but I'm, as I've talked to you about before, Renato, currently cataloguing my book collection, half of which are overseas, and looking at what I have Miyatake-wise, right? So I've got the Miyatake Macross and August works, design works.
Oh, you have that?
Yeah, I have that. That's like a good
the
book.
The Suginami Animation Museum had that in their library, and I went over to read it the other day, and now it's gone.
Oh, I didn't take it. I had mine way before that.
So, no.
What are you accusing me of?
I'm saying I never got it, okay. And I wanted to read it because of something that I was writing or something, and it wasn't there anymore, and so now I'm actually looking for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason I'm asking is, you know, that is all his Macross work from the original through to VFX, and his August work. Is there a general Miyatake design works book? You know how Kawamori has his Macross design works and his more general design works?
Actually, there... I have one which is a bit small. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't remember the title. I think it is just Miyatake design works, but it's actually like postcard sized.
Oh, really?
And it's very thin.
Interesting.
Just is because it looking
Miyatake
at...
Miyatake or Studio Neue?
Miyatake.
Interesting, because there's been a couple of books that have covered Studio Neue as a whole.
Yeah.
The Entertainment Bibles?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, not those. And then there's another one which I don't have, I think, but I don't remember much about it.
Okay. Well, I was just asking because looking at this list of titles he's worked on...
Yeah. There's nothing really extensive and definitive, if right. That's what you're asking, right? There's no...
Yeah, because
Miyatake complete works.
That's what I want. You know?
That's what I want.
And there should be.
There should be. Absolutely.
I mean,
look
he has
a list.
He has a lot of work in some of the, you know, the Yamato 2199 books. In the Yamato 2199 books, yeah. In the original Yamato books, they've got pages upon pages. But hopefully, yeah.
They and there probably will be, because in the talk show, they mentioned that he found a lot of stuff. Mm. And this, you know, you said this was just a small selection and he could fill
like
the entire ship.
One tenth
or something?
He
said, yeah, there is a lot more. And do you guys want to see more? Because we could do loads of these. We could do a series of these. And everyone was like, yeah, do it, boy.
And
they didn't say do it, boy.
Well, we can hope so because, you know, Takani's... representative said there would be another Takane exhibit as well, and there has yet to be any word on that.
Yeah, we're still hoping for that.
Mikimoto said that there was a proposal for a...
No one believe any Mikimoto promises ever anymore.
He said there was a proposal for a more comprehensive art book of all his Macross work.
He also
and
said
that never came
Macross the First would continue in the future.
I will at some point, just not in our future or immediate future.
Mikimoto the Second, his son will take over.
So what else was in this exhibit, guys? What jumped out to you?
Go ahead. In the exhibition?
In the exhibit itself.
Okay. I have more notes, you know. I wrote a bunch of them.
Well, let's just cover the exhibit
okay,
first.
Okay, all right.
So you had the Macross
Well, I really
stuff,
just... But... Okay, I'll tell you what I liked.
Okay.
But I don't have a picture of it anymore because we're not allowed to take photographs, and they never printed any of them, not that I can see. I really liked this design called the... I don't know how to pronounce it. The Coelacanth Star Clipper.
Was that the fish-looking thing?
Yes. It's actually here.
No. Is this? Mm-hmm. Oh, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Then it's not that.
Okay.
I don't like that fish.
Yeah, but, there was...
Oh, they made a postcard out of it.
Yep.
No, that's not what I... What is it? Is it this? The Advanced Asparus Stage 3?
I think that was it. This is the
you
one
know what
we
I'm
were,
talking about?
We, like, we were talking about... And the timeline that we've been made in overlapped with some other work you did. We'll see
yeah,
there...
Yeah, yeah,
1992-ish. Yeah.
We'll see I mean, there this was going over... And the Japanese people thought we were crazy because we were poring over this tiny picture.
This was a small room, but we spent a lot of time in it.
We did. And the one thing that was...
Nerds.
Yeah.
Nerds!
The one thing that surprised me, and I originally thought it was a disappointment, but have since changed that opinion, was there was a lot of Eureka 7
work. Either
it
was
there.
A disappointment or it wasn't.
Well, at the
about
time...
How you feel, right?
At the time, literally, what? One quarter of the exhibit, or maybe one fifth of the exhibit, was Eureka 7.
What is all this Eureka 7?
Now, what
Eureka
is
7, not Eureka.
Exactly. What is all this? Now...
This is the wrong 7.
As we,
7 didn't do this.
As we'll get to, there was... a reason behind that. Also, they inspired me to actually sit down and finally watch all of the original Eureka 7, which I did on Blu-ray.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I absolutely loved it. So
it doesn't hurt that it had both Kawamori and Miyatake on it. So.
Yeah.
It did. And I now have a TV with three toys obstructing my view of it because of this exhibit's influence. So, you know, he's making money for other people, I guess.
Darn that Miyazaki.
It's the otaku life.
Miyazaki.
Again with the...
I'm never going
to... All right, so the exhibit's the exhibit. It's a bit hard to describe as all these things are when there's no book or anything to refer to, but it had just over 70 pieces, minimal Macross, but plenty. They also had some submarine designs he'd done. There were these fish-looking Darius designs. There was a lot of Eureka 7.
The Star Clipper that we just mentioned.
And there were other designs he did for TV commercials, which is, I think...
It's not Darius, by the way. It's Darius.
Oh, it's Darius now.
I know. It's Darius sounds more natural to say, but very recently I looked at the katakana.
Isn't Darius?
It's Darius. No.
Oh, really?
You're thinking of Gradius.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Gradius.
Oh, same thing.
it's terrible. Anyway.
Rockman, Sonic, same game.
Did you mean Mega Man?
So then there was this talk show, as we've referred to, right? And
are you going to talk about the talk show first, or are you going to talk about the thing that we were getting to, which is
okay? Yeah, good
the
point.
most impressive thing there.
So there was one piece of art in this exhibit which was so impressive to us that we sat there and started recording about it on the spot, trying to read details and stuff.
Since we couldn't take any photographs of it, the only way we could record what was there is our own voice.
And do you want to tell us what this was, Renato?
Well, I thought you were going to talk about the other one.
Well, there's two of them, but it's a set.
Come on. Okay, so I hope that by now, if you're listening to this, you have an idea of what the powered suit design from Starship Troopers, the Studio Nui version, looks like, or what it is. If you don't, stop now, Google it. Image search, and you will see something that looks, if you're a Macross fan, like a destroyed Tomahawk.
And we didn't mention that he did design... like the Tomahawk and the Defender.
Yeah, he designs all the Destroids. So, this design, obviously based on Heinlein's description of the...
power suit.
Yeah, the... What is it actually called? The mobile infantry, right? This powered suit... there's two images of the powered suit next to each other on this... in the exhibition. And... one of them is one of those cutaway internal structure illustrations that you often see. Like Egan was describing the Mazinger one, which of course at the time was very en vogue thing to do. They had cutaways of Raideen, they had cutaways of Combatler V, they had cutaways of
Macross, of course, and Gundam.
Yeah. Macross and Gundam, and they were very, very much in fashion at the time. I was out drinking with Matt out last night, and he is crazy about collecting these small toys that they sold with the internal parts exposed under a layer of transparent, translucent plastic. So I met this collector friend of his called Aoki-san, and he took out from his pocket this tiny box. I didn't ask him how much he paid for it, but this Gundam, which had a removable... you know, front, which was translucent and had all the internal art. And so he's one of these internal mecha cutaway fetish guys. They're out there. It's a small group of...
That is a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing.
Wow.
But, you know, and you look at this and it looks cool because it looks like a schematic, basically, what they're trying to replicate. And like a schematic...
like
a schematic that Miyazaki drew... it's got lots of text around it. Like, it's supposed to be...
technical
to give
descriptions.
The impression of technical statistics and...
technical details, yeah.
And the thing is that you could never read them. This illustration is very famous, but you couldn't read them until now. Because we went up really close.
Again, people were looking at us like we're crazy.
And I was squinting my eyes... and I said, okay, this is fascinating. Look at all the stuff that they've... you know, obviously they never intended anyone to read this. It's just like an internal joke. You remember like in those Macross episodes, wherever you see a monitor and you freeze it... like, Egan, you've documented it for the compendium and for the liner notes, right? Anyway, what did I say? I don't know, I don't remember. But I recorded what I read... of these
and it's,
images.
It all makes sense, but none of it has anything to do with the design of the suit.
No, it's all like Studio Nui, proposed converter.
It's like Studio Nui, number one, greatest Studio Godzilla or something, right?
Yeah.
It's just all this...
here it goes. Look, you can actually even see it on this. Studio Nui is beautiful, strong, the great, the biggest, the Godzilla, Mothra, Rodan.
And these are, it's this tiny print around this mechanical illustration.
By the way, we don't have the original in front of us or anything. This is on the postcard.
If you're a science fiction geek, he even draws some shout out to Highland and to Clark.
Asimov.
And shows, which of them is his favorite author.
Yeah.
So, but the one next to it was what? After poring over this thing, then we get to the picture next to it.
Okay, you describe that one.
Well, it's an illustration. It's an illustration of the power suits. And there is a story behind it. It was a color illustration, a sketch on a shikishi, which is a Japanese cardboard square signing
sketches
board.
Sketches and signatures, yeah.
Which you've probably seen if you've ever gone to a Japanese... No, if you've ever gone to an anime con, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Macro Con, they have lots of them. Sean's a collector of those things.
And so they've drawn this. Now, it's not the huge... Like, it doesn't take up the entire piece of cardboard. It takes up maybe a third. And they presented it to Heinlein when he was in Japan in the early 80s, briefly, apparently, because it's the first I'd heard of it. And they showed it to him and got him to sign it. Now,
it's funny that they didn't give it to him.
Well, this is the thing. According to Kato, they gave it to him to sign. He thought it was for him. They're like, no, can we have it back now, please?
Right. Which is weird, because they should have given it to him. What is the...
I know.
I mean, I know that the point is... to use it as a kind of a PR piece, I think.
I imagine.
Like, he signed it, and look, he was here, kind of thing.
It might have been from a convention. Yeah, it said it was for one of the early conventions, which eventually became Daikon, which eventually became the first entry to what people know for Gainax.
Yes.
Right.
So, it's like when one of those times they invited him over, and they had this.
And the thing is... I must point out here, the culture when it comes to autographing something is very different in Japan because of Chinese characters and the calligraphy that they have.
Right.
Than in the West. If you want to put presence or make a statement, you know, you can do very artistic versions of signatures. You can do it very big or very small. You can emphasize characters. Whereas in the West, you know, a signature, autograph or otherwise, is a form of identification. It's supposed to fit on the dotted line on a check. So... They presented this to Heinlein to sign, and his signature is not that big, and it leaves almost two thirds. This illustration, this tiny signature, of the paper, blank. So
it's
problem.
Very utilitarian, right? It's just like he's signing it as in he's approving it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
and I'll take it now, please.
Yeah, you know, they went to his translator, who was also well known, and they're like, they're trying to get some more signatures on this thing, some more autographs. And they're like, well, he's the creator. We can't put our name bigger than his. So they wouldn't write their name larger than his name.
Yeah.
So now they've got two small names. So it took 33 years, but they pulled this out at the talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to read that, Renato? Filled in, like, the remaining, third of the document, of the page?
Yeah. 33年 の時を経て、ついに完成! Which... out of context, I didn't really understand what that meant. It means, it means, after 33 years, it's finally complete. And so this is written in big writing next to the image of the powered suit.
And the tiny, tiny signatures.
And then tiny signatures at the bottom. And I'm thinking, what does it mean complete? Like, the design was complete. And then I realized they're not talking about the design, they're talking about the list of signatures.
Right.
Right, so...
So
even though Heinlein is long gone, they finally got all the signatures that they needed.
They built up all the white space.
Yeah. They basically took them 33 years to fill up the blank space. And that final comment about 33 years was made at the end of the talk show they had on the opening of the exhibit, where they actually wrote that. So it was, and then they went and put it as the key piece of this display. And it's an amazing illustration, and the fact it's got Heinlein's autograph on it.
All these key
amazing
figures who brought Starship Troopers into the world and significantly brought it to Japan and gave us some of the more iconic designs for the powered suits.
Because you've got Heinlein, and then below it now you've got the
translator,
and then you've got Miyatake's autograph, bigger than both of them, dated 2015. So it did take them 33 years to finish this, and it's an amazing piece I've never seen or heard before. Like, it must have been one of the things he came across. Because, as you said he dug up a lot of stuff he didn't know he had when looking for this exhibit. I've heard stories of the piles of papers.
Let's go to his house.
I know we should, shouldn't we? Except, what, are we going to call his mobile phone in advance, right?
What advance? Just turn up at his house.
Right. What mobile phone was the point?
Yeah, I know, but...
Which, okay, so let's pull that into the talk show. So, as always with these things, you know, there are some nuggets of information in this talk show which were great. A lot of it was fluff, a lot of it was joking.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Miyatake, who helped, Kato was there as well.
Kato Naoyuki, and then who was the presenter?
The presenter whose name I always forget. He did all the Yamato 2199 talk shows. He used to be a journalist for Out magazine, and he's basically an academic. An anime academic, and I'll probably remember his name after this. But he's a really good MC as well, because he grew up with the shows, and he's very much not fake. Like, he was making jokes about bad design choices and screw ups, and
yeah,
it was all the back and forth was really good. And he needed to, because Miyatake is notorious for kind of being quiet, being a recluse, for being cut off from everything. I've seen Miyatake talk at a few Yamato events for at screenings, but I've only ever seen him at one, other than this, one autograph session, and that was for a Macross event. And when he entered, people stood and just applauded. And he wasn't entering to talk. He wasn't entering to do anything. He was entering to sit at the table and say, "Next, please," and have people bring their book up to get autographed. And people gave him a standing ovation. Now... And that was completely grassroots, completely organic. So he's really highly respected, but he doesn't interact with people all that much. I mean, I see him on the floor at Wonderfest, talking to people that, you know, about designs and stuff. But he does, he comes in, does a whirlwind tour of it, and kind of leaves. So this was a big deal, this talk show. And everyone was lucky he turned up, because there's something, I know you've mentioned this before, Renato. So Miyatake does not... is not on great terms with technology, shall we say. He doesn't have a mobile phone. He doesn't use
email. I can totally relate.
He doesn't use email. He uses basically fax and snail mail.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's almost impossible to get a hold of. So they said that...
his car is a manual.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So the biggest problem they had with this talk show is that they had no idea if he'd actually turn up or not. And even Kato came by bicycle, right? And he rode 4 hours on bicycle to get to this exhibit.
Yeah.
Again, remember what I was saying about these eccentric designers and creators from back in the day? They all get
Kato more still in Studio Nui, right?
I think so.
Is he one of the three?
Well, with all the 2199 stuff, he often does those live paintings. He's done at least two or three times. Really? Where he does a wall-size Yamato with a time-lapse camera.
Wow.
And they're always amazing.
With a time-lapse camera? That means that was recorded, right?
Like, they recorded. Was it online? It was when they were doing it. I don't know what happened afterwards. But, yeah, well, they do all the... He's done it at least twice. He's huge, exhibits, pieces of Yamato art. So I haven't kept up to date with any other work he's doing, like, design-wise.
They did model kit boxes. The Arcadia.
Okay.
Makes not the sense. Toy company, the Matsumoto Leiji.
So, and he was there, and he was a joker. I'd never actually seen him in person before. So there's this talk show, and there are nuggets of information, also nuggets from the pamphlet. I thought it'd be good if we could pull some of these out and convey them. So, I think the most interesting topic that got brought up, and you've already kind of covered this, Renato, was the whole reality versus realism.
Yeah, that came up many times during the talk show.
And what was interesting was that Macross was brought up in specifically about this.
Right.
In that, you know, Macross has a reality, it adheres to its own reality, but you wouldn't call it realistic, which is very much... And he's talking about the original Macross here, not Frontier, not anything else. So for him to come out and say that, when I know a lot of fans in the West hold the original... And this, you know, from experience,
the war drama,
they hold
the
it up as this
realism.
Exactly. And he doesn't see it like that. He's like, no, it holds to its own laws of reality, but it's not realistic. He's like, yeah, robots.
Yeah. He wanted to make it much more realistic, and he says that in this interview here
in the pamphlet too.
He says he wanted to make it really realistic, but it was too complex to make a toy show out of. So they had to basically
Distill it, trim it down.
Yeah. Make concessions.
Right.
For the... it's going a bit off topic, since you mentioned Macross, in this outside of the talk show, in this pamphlet, he talked a little bit more regarding Macross. He said that, of course, he mentioned genocidus and stuff like that, but we talked about genocidus already. Ishiguro was, you know, Noboru Ishiguro, the lead director on the original Macross, of course, has this kind of special brain function where
he's the Budolzer of
the... he's got the music, sheet music, the stave. You know what the stave is? Mm-hmm. Like the five lines where you plot the sheet music. Running through his head while he's composing the storyboards. And that helps with the timing and the plotting of the episode. So it's a musical anime, basically. And Ishiguro is the only director, at least at the time, that could have formulated anime episodes in that way, always synchronizing the timing of the music and the songs with the visuals. Kawamori, of course, right, that's what I'm getting. There's a mentor and apprentice relationship.
There's always
learned
two,
all of that
a master
from
and
him.
An apprentice.
Yes, learned all of that from him. So Kawamori does that all the time now. And, you know, it's taken to its extreme in the final episode of Macross Frontier.
Or Sayonara no Tsubasa.
And Sayonara no Tsubasa, right? I mean, even something like Do You Remember Love was amazing for its time. Like the final sequence, the 7-minute ending climax thing. A lot of people were just floored by that, how seamless it is. He said it was really hard to edit that perfectly. But the Sayonara and the Tsubasa, if you've ever watched that movie or heard of it, it's the second Macross Frontier movie that nobody watched because they saw the first one and they said, oh, this is just a retread of the original series, screw that. I know many fans said that.
I've come across more recently, actually, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
The second movie is the only thing you need to watch, I swear to God. Forget about the rest. Anyway, that is fantastic with that. It's basically, you know, Ishiguro grammar but taken to the max. So to that, the flip side of that is that while Miyatake is all about the world building, he is tone deaf, so he cannot do that. That's the one thing he cannot do. Ishiguro at the time was the only director in the anime industry that could do that, and you know that baton thing has been passed to Kawamori.
Well, in regards to Kawamori as well, one thing the MC brought up, which I thought was interesting, was that he always saw Miyatake's designs as being made as mechanical designs, almost as like schematics.
Yeah.
Whereas he said, you know, Kawamori's designs seem to be very much made for a 2D medium. Whereas, so Miyatake's stuff requires more adaptation for anime. Whereas Kawamori's designs, because, as you said, he came on board already knowing anime and designing for the medium. So as a result, he's like, there's this difference between the kind of 3D nature of Miyatake's designs compared to the more 2D nature of Kawamori's designs. And again, this is, I guess this is the difference between, and again, these are nonsensical terms, but, you know, a mechanical designer and then a vision creator. And then I guess next that you could put Tengen as a visual artist. You know,
yeah.
A lot of people who are not as, who don't go as deep into these things think, you know, designer, artist, you know, same thing. And listening to them talk at this talk show, you can really hear the difference between a mechanical designer and someone who designs things for animation and someone like Tengen who's more of an illustrator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If I had to put it into simple terms of what the difference, if you had to see a Kawamori design and a Miyatake design, so, and you can instantly spot the difference between the two, Kawamori's designs is like he's a draftsman. He's an architecture or someone who's drafting a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Miyatake, there's a texture to his works.
Yeah, yeah.
Be it, no, the mechanical works he does has a biological feel to it. His biological stuff has a mechanical feel. You feel, like you said, there's a three-dimensionality to it.
Hmm.
Which leads very neatly to what they were talking about next in the talk show, which was about animation and making things move in basically a 2D space, which is your television set, right? Animators prior to Macross had this robot design. And then he inserts things that we've already talked about on this podcast.
Like skirts on hips. Like,
yeah.
Super robot design.
Exactly. Like,
robots stand from the hips.
If you were, if you read those translations that I did, or if you were at Macross World Convention last year where they had the big Orgus panel, Miyatake, is that his name? The guy we were talking about for 2 hours? He kept referring to, you know, robots with skirt armor and like the hips, right? Robots have to stand with the hips. And what he means is that it's not, you know, those robots were designed because were designed with like boxy hips because prior to the Valkyrie and the Orgus, the robots only needed to look boxy, and you would be fooled into thinking that those things are moving. Because when you draw a box from different angles and then run those pictures together, it looks like the box is moving around. But then that limits what you can do. With the translations that I made and with the talk show, with the video message, or is it just a sound message? I don't know, I wasn't at the convention. With whatever the message was.
Oh, the letter.
Yeah, the letter, yeah, which I translated as well. I translated that as well, by the way. So he was basically talking about just the aspect of design. But here in his talk show, he's taking it further and talking about the aspect of animating that design. So it's basically, your brain is fooled into thinking that this is moving just because it's a box reshot from different angles. So when you get into more complicated stuff, like the Dumbine, he specifically avoided the example of Macross because then we get into technicalities with, you know, Kawamori transformations or whatever. But the Dumbine, like you said, Egan, you said that his designs have both mechanical and biological aspects of that. That Dumbine is like the pinnacle of that. Indeed. Right? They're bugs. They're giant bugs. But they're also robots. They're mecha. And they don't have straight edges. None of them. Right? They're not boxes. They're very curved. There's lots of relief. There's some embossing effects there. So it's very, very difficult to animate that. And he said, I don't remember the name, but I think he named one key animator, and he said that's the only guy who could animate the Dumbine properly, and everyone else is just...
He did write off a lot of other people.
Yeah. Well, they did that throughout the whole...
They did.
The whole talk show. Like, Kato said, I only accept Miyatake's Yamato, not any other Yamato. I don't accept them.
Yeah, that was kind of like, huh? Well, all
and the... I just came back from an exhibition of Itabashi something, I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Who did
Matsumoto Leiji
art. Yeah.
I've met him before. At one of the Leiji Future talk shows.
I would have met him if I was allowed to enter the signing event, but you had to bring your own book, and I thought that you could buy the book there.
Which book?
That book that I was telling you about, the Itabashi and
the last book. 5,000 yen.
It's 5,000 yen, which I would have bought...
If it was there.
If it was there. But even if you buy it, all you get is a ticket for a lottery to participate in the signing event.
Welcome to Japan.
Yes.
So...
Thanks.
Another time that... the parallels of Kawamori...
Hang on, there's a coda to this story.
Okay.
I actually went around... The town. This is in Oji, right? So it's really far out of Tokyo. I went around and I couldn't find a bookshop because I wanted to buy the book. And I asked the policeman, "Where is it?" And he led me around to the other side of town. And there was this tiny, you're surprised that it still survives kind of bookshops with an old man behind the counter. And he's got his hand on the book, right? And there's a giant poster advertising the book. And I'm like, "I'll have that, please." And he said, "Is your name on the list?" And I'm like, "What list? What is this?" And he waved this piece of paper in front of my face. "Did you order? Did you pre-order?" And I'm like, "I didn't pre-order anything." It was like, and then he lectures me. He's like, You see, everyone comes early. You can't just waltz in here into my store and expect to be treated. And I'm like, I just found out about this goddamn book. I'm sorry. And I walked away.
You know, we always talk about how we get in line and go through raffles and all this, but failure to do so results in what you've just experienced.
Yeah, lecturing.
So if I can bring this back to Kawamori briefly. Something I noticed that Miyataka had in common with Kawamori. Because I've heard him give Kawamori crap before. You know, at talk shows. You know, always when he's not there, of course. is that he expressed a very similar sentiment in that he does not like doing the same thing twice.
Yes.
And this is something Kawamori said on multiple occasions with Macross, right?
Yeah.
And to the point that he, when asked about the powered suit from Starship Troopers, which is very much, despite being one of the first things he worked on, considered one of his career-defining works, he said he wants to be free of it.
He wants to be released.
It's holding him down. He doesn't like the legacy of it.
Yeah.
And that he's sick of people talking about it. Well, when it comes to approaching him about it, you know.
Which segues into one of his most recent credits, at least the ones as of last year when the exhibit came out. The most recent thing he did is something called CrossAnge, one of the latest works of Sunrise.
CrossAnge, yeah.
But you might think, it has robots, it has features of craft. Did he work on those?
Is that the one where the girl gets raped?
She gets
the infamous
eaten.
One, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
He didn't work on the robots. He didn't work on the vehicles. He drew the dragons in them. So it's like, he's even at this stage of his life saying, I got to do all these different things beyond what people know me for.
Hmm. And, yeah, I CrossAnge, damn.
Mind blank.
So he was asked, you know, well, what would you do if someone asked you to do the power suits again? And he's like, well, if I can redesign it, you know, from a modern sensibility, from what I'm into now, what I'm doing now, I wouldn't be against that. But I don't want to do the same thing over again. That's holding me back. And that just seemed to fit so well with the way Kawamori expresses it as Macross as a franchise.
Yes. You know?
I thought it was really quite interesting.
Something that I was thinking about as we're talking about this, you know, every work has its own worldview. We often argue with people,
mm-hmm.
especially about Delta, where people say this isn't Macross. It's not what it used to be. You know, playing devil's advocate, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's. Would you say that each Macross, even though they're all part of one continuity, technically, they're all their own world view? Isn't that what Kawamori is alluding to with all these different interpretations of the, you know, if I tell it this way, it's a TV show, and if I tell it as a movie, then it appears like this. So basically, isn't he saying that all of these different interpretations of Macross are their own worldview? So you couldn't, even though they're starting to mix it up a lot now, especially Macross 30, you couldn't really credibly have Spiritia retconned into the original Macross. You couldn't really credibly have Battle 7 fighting the Zentradi, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, they're different worldviews.
Right, and he gets around that by his explanation, which may be a cop-out, depending on how you look at it, all of them being different media representations of events.
Yeah.
You know, the core events happen, but everything is equally as fictional. And that is both simultaneously, you know, it can be seen as a cop-out, it can be seen as the most meta thing ever, which he thought of before we were coining the term meta, really. Yeah. But yeah, no, I think the interesting thing about Macross there is that it allows it to come up with, as you said, all these different world settings with a different reality for each setting,
yeah.
A different sense of realism for each reality. And in that manner, it's not beholden to, for example, all the rules that UC Gundam is.
Yes.
You know, to get around this problem, UC Gundam or Gundam has to go and make all these spin-offs, Gundam Wing or G Gundam. Whereas Macross wants to do G Gundam, it's like, all right, this is a version of a story that did happen in the world of Macross, but this is the kids' TV version of it. So we can make it like this. So it's both, it can be frustrating depending on how you look at it, or extremely liberating, I guess, in other ways. Yeah.
Definitely from the creator's point of view, liberating.
Certainly. Now, one thing I remember hearing about Miyatake was around 2004, he had some kind of... He was hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was for a stroke, but don't quote me on that. And he did briefly mention this in the talk show in a way that explained one of my disappointments that then became a not-so-disappointing disappointment. If that makes any sense.
It doesn't, because a disappointment is a disappointment. You've now rationalized it and understood why you were disappointed, but it doesn't change history. You were still disappointed.
I know, but in retrospect. So he was hospitalized, and basically he was bedridden after this, what I think was a stroke. Despite this, however, he did his best to keep working. Apparently, despite being unable to move in this bed for 2 days before even starting to get better, representatives from Sunrise would come by and be like, oh, we've got a work request for you. We're going to leave the paper on your bedstand here. And then they left.
The so guy's like in a coma.
So he
when you wake up.
Yeah, there'll be work waiting for you when you get up. So, you know, he was going through this incredibly...
Better step out of it quick, because this will just pile up, man.
Oh, they actually said, we'll give you 2 weeks for this one. Welcome to Japanese company life. So...
He's not even an employee of Sunrise.
He was recovering, and the recovery took him weeks and weeks. At one point, you know, he could only use his right hand to draw. And he said this didn't stop him from drawing. He could still put lines on paper. He could still make good drawings. But he did feel like the designs... He was delivering what was requested, but he couldn't get his designs or art to reflect what he was trying to portray, what he was trying to show. That degree of nuance. Maybe it was detail. I don't know. But... He could only use one arm to really hold the paper down and draw with his right hand. But during this time, he got a project which kind of helped him get over this, and that was Eureka 7. And in Eureka 7, he wasn't doing the mecha designs. That was Kawamori. He did buildings, including this tower, which was actually on the... Was it the front page of the pamphlet? Or the,
that's right.
And the inside, I think, as well.
Second
page, right? Yep, here we go. Here, yeah, it's just this tower.
Yes, yeah.
And having gone back and watched Eureka 7, I don't even remember what this was from. But
it's 10,000 meters tall.
It's this huge citadel tower that appears in Eureka 7. And he had multiple drafts of it, multiple versions, different backgrounds, and he was so proud of the work he did on that series. He really, really thinks it's a great series. Mm-hmm. And it has this emotional attachment that helped him get over this medical condition he had in 2004. I remember people saying around then they didn't know if he'd ever work again.
Really?
And you look at this list of works in this pamphlet that he's done since then, and he hasn't slowed down. He's not doing as much straight on mecha,
yeah,
as he used to, but no, he has not slowed down. So that was why we had all this Eureka 7 in the exhibit. And hearing that after the fact, it added this emotional, you know, angle to it. Plus, I went back and watched the series. Hence, I was initially disappointed. I came to realize why it was the way it was.
Okay. Hey, presto. All right, I think you're vindicated.
Yay!
Justified enough. I think also a lot of the reasoning for putting, you know, so many different variations of that tower picture is because in the pamphlet he goes into a lot of detail talking about the meaning behind this tower that basically, again, like I said, it encapsulates this whole idea that the reality is there and that you take motifs from real life, but you build the reality of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So what he was saying was that you know, they gave him this commission. They said, okay, we've gone through many different artists trying to represent this 10,000 meter tall tower structure thing, and this is what we've gotten, and we'd like you to do it because we literally have no one else, and they're not hitting the mark. And he had, by this point, of course, late in his career, he's got this knack of knowing, just by looking at the early draft planning stages of any new show in pre-production, the very early stages of pre-production, hearing the pitch, he knows what the essence of the show is, and therefore that becomes key to the design. So they've explained 10,000 huge structure. Okay, this is what we got to do. Make it like a cloud. All of the designs you're showing me here are like giant, heavy objects that the ground would never support. They would just collapse under their own weight. It's not like a space elevator from Orgus that doesn't need to collapse under its own weight. Doesn't need to support its own weight. So make it like a cloud. Like, have the wind rushing through it. Make it, like, ethereal. Because clouds are the largest structures in the sky. So if you evoke the cloudness into this giant structure, it will be believable. It would be huge and also light at the same time.
You can also back up all your phone data on the cloud. So it's...
He would never say anything.
I know,
like,
right?
That.
That's why I love him.
You could say that, and he would be like, "What are you talking about?"
Oh, speaking of which, yes. So touching again on his reluctance with technology, he did mention drawing digitally.
Facts.
Well, then again, fax is old as it may be. My company has. I know many companies.
My house has
fax.
A fax machine. Yeah. I used it.
It's still quite used. And Kato did mention...
Kato talked about the fax because Miyatake has made a point about the fact that he only needs... To do work, he only needs a pencil, a pen, a paper, a phone, not necessarily a mobile one, and a fax machine. Because he can work from home there. He used to live in Tokyo, still anyway. but as he got more and more books and more materials... you know, he ran out of space, so he went back to his parents' house, which was empty, so he just put all his stuff there and now lives from there and works from there. So he often faxes some designs, and Kato was telling a story about some, I don't think it was the Yamato, but it was some other design that he had a commission to do an illustration for, but it was a Miyatake design, and so he had to have access to the materials, and Miyatake faxed it to him, and he said, this sucks, this isn't the design, this is a very poorly, literally a facsimile of your thing. And I want the real thing, because there are things that you can only tell about the design, almost like the texture that Egan was talking about. If you are looking at the original drawing from Miyatake, with all the nuances that the pencil and pen lines have, and and even the mistakes that have been inked out, right? Or blotted out, whited out.
Which was the one Macross picture that had the exhibit, including the white out.
Yes.
On the crotch.
Which was still...
And, yeah, when we talk about his family's parents' home, one thing we've neglected to mention is the reason this was at Yokosuka. This exhibit was because he's originally from Yokosuka. And, you know, much like, you know, Matsumoto Leiji has statues of his characters in his town.
Uizumigakumi.
Yeah. They're making a big deal out of
him. But they're very recent, though.
Well, but let me finish here. They're making it like, as in the mayor turned up at the beginning of this talk show with flowers.
Yeah.
For Miyatake. This is an artist, a mechanical designer who is known only to the hardcore of the hardcore, really. And the mayor of the town is coming with a bouquet of flowers.
Well, this was organized by the local government.
That's how they
managed
to get the
Mikasa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how they managed to get the space, because, you know, local government's willing to front the money for it and the space, and boom, they could do it. It's very niche. You know, but it all tied back to the fact that he was from Yokosuka, which I thought was great. Also, again, touching on how he doesn't like to use technology, is he was talking about digital drawing, and Kato said he does sometimes use a digital tablet. And Miyatake was saying that the amount of time, the lag...
Yeah, lag.
...from the input to seeing something on the screen, that may only be, you know, milliseconds. However, to him, that is introducing this whole new dimension of lag, which inhibits him being able to put his thought, his imagination onto paper as quickly as possible. If he's got the lag of looking at something on a screen, that is not the pace at which he's thinking. That is not the pace at which he's drawing. So he refuses to draw digitally. Although even Cuttle said that apparently for a lot of his digital drawing stuff, he said he uses a CRT monitor because it's got less lag on the input than an LCD.
Yes, it does, and which is why... Which ties into what we're going to do after the podcast, which is playing Mega Man 7 on the Super Famicom.
Not on the Super Famicom.
Rockman 7
on the Retro,
on the Freak. Retro Freak. You freak. You Retro Freak.
Some HDMI.
Yeah, because, you know, hardcore players of really, really tough-as-nails games, like, you know, bullet hell shooters and stuff, will only play on CRTs because the reflex time is just too bad.
All right, well,
on a flat screen.
Well, let's wrap this up with...
You're not going to cut that out. I won't let you. Mega Man 7.
I'm going to. I wasn't going to.
Okay.
So, all right, then. Let's wrap this up, then.
The only thing Miyataka didn't design.
With the one thing people might be interested in hearing that's very contemporary, and that is, as going by this list, Miyataka has been involved in pretty much every Macross to date. 33 years, in one capacity or another.
Yes.
I don't know they did anything for Macross 30, but animated-wise at least.
Yeah.
And Macross 2, well, his ship was in there.
So you get a credit
for
it.
That's true. Yeah.
So is he going to be involved with Delta?
He going to be involved with Delta? Well, this is what they said at the talk show. Apparently he's involved in some way. We don't know what he's doing yet. That's all.
Because we know that Tomas Romain is doing what you would think Miyataki is doing in the environments, the planets, the world.
Yeah, the so-called production design, right?
So in that case, I'm like, well, what is Miyataki doing? And we don't know who's designed that Macross-class ship that we saw in the initial teaser.
I don't think that he would do that for the same reasons that he wouldn't do Starship Troopers again, right?
Right.
He must be...
Well, then what is he doing?
Well, here's the thing. It's not so much what he's doing. It's that when whatever he's doing does finally appear on the screen, we know?
Well, because it will have been sent in by fax, so we'll know. It'll be blurry compared to everything else.
It'll be like 15 DPI.
So he is...
And you think they're complaining about the renders now?
Look at the texturing on this.
Yeah. So Orgus! Maybe he did that! Maybe he did the freight ship! There you go.
Oh, boy. So we know he is involved in some capacity, and that was actually let slip, wasn't it? It sounded like he wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, who was it that said
it? It was MC mentioned.
Talking
about it. And he brought up a few other points. Like, he was like, you know, can we get rid of the love triangles now? I think we're done with the love triangles.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, also the name, you know, Super Dimension.
It's Itano, who on the commentary said, can we get rid of Kawamori? I think we're done with Kawamori. Straight up. And they didn't bleep that out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The MC also said, you know, can we also get rid of the name Super Dimension? He's like, I thought that was cool in the 80s. It's kind of lame. And Miyataki was like, I came up with that name.
Yeah. He actually came up with the original name, which if you go to the really, really old packages of the merchandising and some of the kits before the show actually aired, apparently it was changed at the last minute. It was Super Dreadnought Fortress.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Chogoku,
something.
Your side. And somebody, I don't know who it was, maybe the producers of the show, even though some merchandise had slipped past, apparently told Miyatake that, you know, this Chogoku, nobody knows what it means, and nobody can write it either. It's a really difficult kanji. It's not recognizable. Nobody can read it, nobody understands what it means, even though they could read it, and nobody can write it. So, change it. And on the spot, he came up with, all right, what about Super Dimension? Chogoku Yosai. There you go.
All right.
And he was like, oh, okay, that'll do. And so that's that.
And that was that. And he mentioned, he's like, you know, it's also kind of awkward when people refer to a Super Dimensional series. Doesn't that feel weird? It's like, yeah, it's just, I just came up with the name. Like,
yeah.
There's no great plan there.
Not only is there no great plan, there's also, like, it's not a series, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, there's no legendary thing that people are going to recognize as a trilogy.
You mean Macross, Orgus, Sudden Cross isn't a trilogy? What?
Yeah. And so, I don't just mean a narrative trilogy. I mean, like, literally people forget about the remaining two parts. Orgus still gets some kind of love, but Southern Cross...
unless Fukuyama's playing the guitar for it at Super Robot
Spirits. That's true. So, which reminds me, I need to get tickets for the new one.
I'll bring it. All right, let's get to that in a moment. So let's wrap up first then, guys. Impressions of the exhibit. Because all this talk, and we really only mentioned the exhibit for a brief period of time, because it was small.
Yes.
But, you know, we've talked about the Kawamori exhibit. We've talked about Macross the Museum. We've talked about Takani. How would you, I don't want to say rank, but how would you compare this to other exhibits we've gone to?
It's similar to the Takani one in terms of the selection of stuff, giving a background into Miyatake as a person, right? It's not similar in the way it was set up, because Takani was at least in an art gallery. Battleship. And it's completely different to the other Macross Gengaten, which, if you remember, I don't know if I expressed this very explicitly, but it was somewhat of a disappointment. I mean, they had good stuff, but it didn't feel human, right? It felt like Big West. I'm talking about the Gengaten, the...
I'm just... Parkour exhibition, I don't walk into an exhibit and think, is this exhibit human?
I do.
Wow, okay.
There's humanity there. Like, we're talking about an artist, right? A creator. So this is totally an insight into his thought process and his work ethic, his approach to his work, which I didn't get at any of the, like, the umbrella Macross exhibitions, if you know what I mean, right? That, to me, just sounds like something that Big West planned out and said, oh, and here we'll put the Macross 7, promo illustration, and here we'll put some cells, they love that kind of stuff. And we'll have Cheryl and Ranka narrate the whole thing on the CD, and you can take the CD home with you. And I'm like, okay, fine.
But I gotta disagree, but then, you know, I found it was very more general and an overview of Macross stuff, but there was stuff I'd never seen the physical versions of before.
Yeah, and it's great to see that.
It's great.
I'm not denying that, but it doesn't give me... It doesn't contextualize.
You're telling me it needed more Eureka 7.
No, because you'd be disappointed.
Okay, Egan.
Yeah, I think that was a major thing about this exhibit. Not as much the art, which, what it was said, it's just a barest glimpse of what he has done over these past few decades.
Mm-hmm.
But that fact that it was on a battleship from his hometown, that you saw from, you know, the ship, you could see the military base, the U.S. military base, which had an obvious influence on his work.
Yes, yes.
It was showing you how and where his roots came from, and where how it influenced and distilled throughout all the stuff he's done since then.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts, like you said, it puts his art in his place. It puts his the artist in his place.
Do you know what this exhibition was for Miyatake? It was this. This postcard that I'm holding up of the schematic cross-section with the internal workings
of the power
suit. That was the highline.
The powered suit.
Yeah.
It was the cross-section cutaway schematic with the internal things showing of Miyatake himself, the man. That's what it was.
Miyatake is 20% Eureka 7, is what you're telling me.
What now?
What a disappointment. All
right. And 70% Russo-Japanese war era battleship. Mikasa right. is Tukasa.
Now, I've heard nothing of any follow-up exhibits, like I was hearing at the Takani one, although that has yet to eventuate. So hopefully, you know, he said they've got all this other material. I'd like to see them do something like this again. I'm not sure that they will. At the very least, I hope they do a book, because
absolutely
not having a book at this exhibit, after looking at the pamphlet and seeing all the stuff that wasn't in the exhibit, it's not that I want a book of everything in the exhibit. I want everything that wasn't in the exhibit as well as what was in the exhibit.
Yeah, yeah.
So hopefully we'll get a more comprehensive design work.
And I mean, like, we're here talking about it, but you know, people can't really imagine what we're talking about half the time,
right,
except for maybe the Macross-related stuff, the anime-related stuff.
Right.
They should really have his book, his introductory volume, you know?
Yeah. It'd be one hell of a book.
Mm.
Or multiple books.
Yeah.
All right.
Encyclopedia Miyatakena.
Anyways, so we're going to leave it there for now, because we've... ranted on about Miyatake and Miyazaki quite a bit.
Da, 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 da. This ending theme.
And on that ending theme, this is the Speaker Podcast folding out.